everyone can see it. So, recording it, yeah. We talk about context. We talk about context of creation and so on, and reception. And I think it helps at this point to understand really clearly what we're looking at in terms of this piece, in terms of the way that American society is developed. So make notes whatever way you fancy, please, but please do. If we start our reading in 1830 and finish it in 1940, we allowed 1830 because we have Huck Finn, written in 1890, but set in 1830. It wins us an extra 50 years to play with, which is actually quite nice. Then we have a few key stages in American development, you could argue, and again, jot these down. So arriving in 1830s, first of all, we're antebellum, we're before the Civil War. We're very much in a relatively agrarian economy where civilization, for want of a better word, to use a Huck word, is just beginning to become established as far west as the Mississippi's, which, if we know our shape of America, runs straight down the middle almost. The other side of the Mississippi is still very much dangerous territory, known as the territories, and it would be the places where not only would there be a fair amount of Native Americans, doing whatever they might be doing, but also it's a place for banditry, it's a place where people on the run would go and hide out and so on. Over the Rockies, right on the west coast, actually California now exists. It has started as people coming up from Mexico into California, but California now exists, and but nothing else does. So you've got this vast emptiness, the other side of that. And within this context, two things still hold firm. We'll talk much more about the theories of the pioneers and so on, the idea of manifest destiny, the idea of the belief that of the original settlers, that this was their land given them to them by God to go out into and turn into essentially God on earth, as it were. But what you've got in this pioneer time is you've got very much an idea of people discovering this vast continent. They're beginning to tame it. So the wilderness is becoming less of a wilderness, and around the 1830s, we're beginning to see townships and so on building up throughout the whole of the area. Because of that, we're beginning to see the establishment of local government, the establishment of hierarchies, the establishment of rules and policing, whatever it might be, essentially turning it into a civilized society rather than a collection of individuals. It's still, however, at this point possible to view America through the eyes of the original idea of the American dream. Hard work will get you self-sufficiency. It may not make you rich, but it's going to make you happy. You're going to be able to go out, build your farm, farm it, and live your life. And the way that I always look at America, an American lit, and I'm not American, might have Americans spinning in their graves, I say it. But the way I always look at it is that is the pure American dream. That is the sense where we're saying, God has given us this great land to go into, and if we work really, really hard and do what he wants us to do, our reward will be our own bit of land, a livelihood, and be able to look after our families and raise families and so on. And that's quite pure. And even by the 1850s, although there are townships building up, that is in essence what we begin to see. Interestingly, in Huck, as you'll see in September, or before, because I'll get you to read it before, we're already being shown evidence of towns on the Mississippi which are sliding into a sort of drunkenness and a laziness and things of this sort of nature, as Twain is beginning to say, look how society was becoming corrupted. But ultimately, it's relatively agrarian and calm. Yes, in the north, there was a lot of industry, and in the south, a lot of agriculture. And that's how the country divided up. 1860s, we see the war. And so anything written around the 1860s has to be seen in the against the background of a civil war, which finished in the mid-60s with slavery being abolished, the slaves being enfranchised, being allowed to be free people, and so on. Interestingly, amongst other things, the vast majority of slaves stayed living on the plantations they had been slaves on and took a relatively meagre wage because they knew the area. They had maybe not great homes, but they had homes there and they didn't want to travel too far. So, you know, slightly odd. But the South by the 1860s had been completely destroyed. The infrastructure was totally destroyed. And we enter a new phase of our American dream, driven by the wealth of the North, where wealthy men in the North began to see that the South was rich for taking, rebuilding, and so on. The South resented that, and still do in many ways. It's still a cause of, you know, the cause of friction. We begin to see that, though. And then there begins this first phase of the industrialization, the opening up of the country. Because around 1870s, 1880s, we begin to see the first huge change to the country, which is the arrival of the railway. Once the railway arrives, and we can begin to date that in the texts we're looking at, all bets are off. People can now move very fast east-west for the first time. The general direction of travel in America until this point, particularly for freight, has been north-south, down the big rivers. Now we can move east-west. Various things happen. The little towns and trading centres along the rivers fall into disuse because they're not needed anymore because they aren't on the railways. And big railway centres build up. So these big cities of the Midwest, like Chicago, like St. Louis, suddenly begin to grow up. Go on.
So just looking at all of this, could we see civilization society as contrasting the American dream?
To a degree, yes, because what happens is the more civilized we get and the more it becomes therefore linked with business rather than life, this would be my contention, the American dream becomes corrupted because the American dream now has money, if you like, at the heart of it. So when this begins to happen very much, the 1880s and stuff, you've read books like Antonia, or some of you have, what we begin to see is that the farmlands empty as people head to the cities, because they suddenly realise that's where the work is, and they can make money in the cities. Yep.
Rather than seeing like corruption, could you see it as more of like adaptation?
Yes, you could. You could. The reason why I see it as corruption is that I would argue that most American literature points us in that direction. In other words, there is this harking back to a time when things were better, and therefore I think corruption works. I mean, the whole point of Huckleberry Finn, to a degree, is to look back at a time when it was innocent and things were better. Twain is remembering his life because he was a pilot on a boat on the Mississippi in the 1850s when life was straightforward and so on, and didn't have this sort of issue. And in there, the clash is between the civilized Tom Sawyer and the uncivilized Huck, and we haven't read it yet, who by the end of the book, Huck goes off on his own, because he's so fed up with what he feels is becoming restrictive and unpleasant about society, shall we say. As the big cities of the Midwest grow up, industry begins to pile into these areas. And then two things happen, I suppose, in the last decades of the 19th century. One is that there's a huge wave of migration to the Midwest, people coming from Europe, usually, mostly Northern Europe, because they can see there's money to be made there. The other thing is that people on the northeast coast get very, very, very rich. So all the old money begins to get excessively rich. And this is the era that Twain called the Gilded Age. Gilded as in G-I-L-D-E-D, as opposed to G-U-I. In other words, a veneer of gold over something much more ordinary. And I think that's the whole point of this time. It begins to take on the trappings of being special whilst not being. And the Gilded Age, broadly, for Twain, is the 1890s. And that merges gently at the beginning of the 20th century to the explosion of what people start to write about in terms of the massive migration that begins to come in, what people begin to call the melting pot of races in the cities. The cities become, well-known books, Theodore Dreiser books like The Jungle and so on. The cities begin to get represented as, well, as in The Jungle, as essentially wild areas of untamed nature which are full of dangerous animals and, you know, heaven knows what's going to happen within them. We begin to see, and one of the best descriptions of it that you have is the beginning of Sister Carrie, when she moves into Chicago and the condition that she's living with her sister. We can see this idea of all these people crammed together, fighting for what there is in basically not really very salubrious conditions. So we get the melting pot, we get this beginning to happen, tainted again in some people's eyes, because of course American culture is now becoming so clearly immigrant culture. We have further layers of issues with migrants. Tom likes to talk about his Nordicism in Gatsby and the idea of basically the world being kept for white, purebred, you know, sort of Nordic Aryan type people. It's not a Fitzgerald isn't massively sort of foreshadowing the rise of the Nazis. What he is doing is reflecting the fact that by this time, the arrival of the South Italians in the first half of the 20th century had really caused a lot of people to get very concerned about migration, because they brought with them all these families from Sicily and so on. You've all watched The Godfather. They brought with them organised crime. And they arrived as crime families. That's the whole point. It's not as though they arrived, settled in, and then things went from bad to worse. They arrived as crime families quite often in terms of the syndicate that would have come over from Sicily to place itself in New York. And you begin to get this sense of issues with migration in that sort of way. That's not even touching the colour of the skin. It's not, you know, it's no longer a race issue, if you like. It's a migrant, you know, it's to do with the immigrant issue of the way they see the migrants. So race in the sense of races and colour in that way. And I mean, again, Carraway has it, doesn't he? He has that little comment about the funeral procession, where he's rude and turned that the narrow lips of the southern Europeans, whatever it is. He talks about the West Europeans, South Europeans, that's what it is. So, you know, we've got that coming in. And at this point, things are not going terribly well, but the war comes. And broadly speaking, the next phase begins to get quite complicated. After the war, there is this group that we refer to as the Lost Generation. These are people like Fitzgerald and people like Carraway. These are the people that went to war, to fight in Europe's war, and came back to America and discovered that America hadn't waited for them. And that instead of being able to come back to America and find that their job was there or their girlfriend was there or whatever, suddenly they felt completely out of place. They've seen Europe, they've taken part in a horrendous conflict, and they come back to America and find that America is actually not the place they thought it was for all sorts of reasons. And at that point, America now at the end of the war is chasing money harder than anything else. It becomes the Roaring Twenties. This society that is chasing money. That's what society seems to be about, and that's what Gatsby's about, isn't it? Everybody in the book doing that. And that sense of this overblown pursuit of money continues through the 20s until the crash. And the literature after the crash then, of course, begins to reflect the Depression. And everything changes again. And one of the interesting things about a lot of Depression literature is the way that it in its own way, it echoes pioneer era, as though it's trying to get back to something purer. And whilst it is true that people fleeing the Dust Bowl travel from east to west and so on, it's hard to ignore these sort of journeys that people are undertaking in this sort of literature, which suggests, almost like the pioneers, a need to move across the continent in order to be able to find a way to earn a living. Now, the reason that these stages are important, I think, comes out when, not so much in an essay about the patriarchy like we did, but if I ask you an essay about greed being at the heart of American society, or the wish for wealth being at the heart of American society. Because what you begin to see then really clearly is you can begin to get this argument. The earlier you are in our stories, the need for wealth is less and less and less important. And we find ways to illustrate that, whether it's Huck giving away $6,000 or whatever it might be. It becomes more and more and more relevant, but it also becomes two things, because it becomes wealth for wealth's sake in a book like Gatsby, which is what the 20s is all about. But of course, the wish for wealth or the wish to make money by the 30s is about living. It's about actually the need to survive. And I would say that's the case as well in the sort of the melting pot era as well. These poor people that we meet in books like Sister Carrie, they just want to make money. They want to live. You know, they're not making money because they're greedy and they want to buy a flashy car. They want to feed themselves. The people on the prairies are not particularly interested in making money. They're interested in their crops and having enough money to put in the next crops. And again, it's purer, perhaps, in the ideal. Yeah.
Could that also be seen as being small-minded?
In what way?
Looking for the next fix instead of having a, like, a reliable and suitable way of living that's more contented by the people who normally have a lot of money.
Which would be, hang on, so which would be small-minded? The farmers?
Yeah, but both in a sense, really. But
you could argue, I suppose you could argue that it's unimaginative. And, you know, that's all that interests them. It does. It's not going to make America great doing that. Might be part of the argument that I could see how you could begin to construct, if you see what I mean. But there's no doubt that the big, powerful men of the late 19th century, who are sitting usually on the northeast coast, making millions out of railroads and out of that sort of heavy industry, which is taking over the country, they are making America a powerhouse. But they're doing it to line their own pockets. And these are the guys who will build the houses, for example, that we meet in Gatsby. Or buy the houses that we meet in Gatsby. If you remember, Tom's house was owned by an oil man. Gatsby's house is owned by a brewer before them. If we assume that the Georgian mansion is what it says it is, and obviously that is a Georgian house, so it goes back to the 18th century. Because it doesn't say it's a copy of a Georgian mansion. But again, these are the sort of people that will live in these houses. Now, you could argue that at least when it was being owned by an oil man, it was being owned by somebody who was making something, you know, for the country in some way in terms of the industry. Whereas Tom Buchanan is just a wealthy polo player who is contributing absolutely nothing to the wealth of the country. We also begin to pick up this idea in Gatsby that everybody travels west to east. It's almost like they're inverting the pioneer movement. And if the pioneer movement was a good thing about going off and finding the great place to be, then when we run it backwards on itself, we are essentially undoing that because we're now pursuing money rather than some form of goodness. And so I would always see almost any essay that you write in this exam as somehow needing to show how the question you've got fits into this arc of the state of almost the American dream and everything that comes out of that between the relative innocence and purity of the 30s and the relative decadence, particularly the 20s, and the after effect of that in the 30s. If you get that, then it's much, much easier to actually write and use the other texts because you can place your texts along that continuum. So that you begin to realise that a text like Grapes of Wrath, of course, is late 30s. So that really is absolutely at their wits' end with the state of their country. Don't forget, America didn't know Japan was going to bomb Pearl Harbor. They didn't know there was going to be a European war. So in 1937, there really is very little positivity on the horizon. The country is wrecked in 1937. In the 20s, you've got every man for himself, and you've got a text like this, so critical of it. And one of the things that interested me in some of your writing about the patriarchy, and most of you wrote sensibly about the fact this is a book in which men dominate and so on, and perhaps the link you then didn't make to it in terms of the question, is this is a book critiquing society. So if it's a book in which society is critiqued and the patriarchy is shown to be so powerful, then surely we're critiquing the patriarchy in some way in these people. And that was the link that most of you weren't making, if you like, to tie your writing about Gatsby to the question. Because what most of you are doing is saying, ah, yeah, there's a patriarch in Gatsby. Look, Tom, deft movement, broken nose. Woo, he's a patriarch. Gatsby must be a patriarch. The women are downtrodden. And, you know, and someone like Jordan is interesting because if the book is a critique, then everybody in it is critiqued. Nobody comes out of this book well. So Jordan, who you're holding up as a different kind of woman, most of you, somebody, and I don't disagree with that, somebody who perhaps is trying to cut it as a man, because effectively she has to behave like a man in order to get on in the man's world. But that's being critiqued as well, because she's part of the process, and she's this curiously, what's the word I'm looking for, sort of asocial, I suppose, figure. She plays a sport which is a totally independent sport. You're only, you know, you are yourself. It's not a team game. She's not a team player at all. You know, she spends a lot of her time just looking vaguely sneering at people and disinterested and whatever. Even her relationship with Nick is hardly a passionate relationship. And at the end, what does she do, of course? She opts to stay with her friend Daisy. Rather than taking her potential as maybe a representative of a different type of society and saying, actually, I'm going to make a go of this. And I'm going to be the sort of person that takes the country to a better place. She doesn't do that. Goes back to Daisy and effectively is written out of the text until we have the throwaway at the end about breaking off the relationship. And so I don't know if that helps. I hope it does. I hope it starts to clarify what we need to be thinking about in terms of the way we link our texts to what we're talking about, but also the way that we can look at creation and reception in terms of times. This book is very definitely a vehicle for the 20s. I mean, it is a you know, really strong book. Nobody was reading it in the 30s. Nobody read it in the 20s because nobody wanted in the 20s to be told they were wrong. And nobody read it in the 30s because, frankly, they found it such an offensive depiction of what they'd all lost. And it blamed them for losing it. So you're not really going to, you know, it took the war to do all sorts of things. It took the war, basically, to allow America to almost sideline its existential problem of where it was going as a nation. Revert to maximum output from all the industries. All the unemployed men ended up in the army. And of course, at the end of the war, America, which was untouched in terms of its infrastructure by the war, is by far the most powerful and wealthy nation on the planet because everywhere else has been destroyed. You know, Europe can't compete and needs American money to rebuild.
Us not being a school that's in America currently, do you still think that the American schools would perceive the book in a different way when we would? Because
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I do try and speak to one or two American colleagues on Twitter about it. I haven't picked up that nobody, I don't think anybody sees this book as a positive affirmation of the American spirit in the 1920s. Let's put it that way. The only people that see that tend to be the filmmakers who want to put this soft focus. You know, here's Leonardo looking handsome and he's got a glass of champagne in his hand. It isn't that wonderful. Oh, it must have been such fun to be alive then.
A lot of American books aren't taught, like, such things like Of Mice and Men and stuff. They're not taught in America.
A lot of books are, well, one of the reasons that a lot of books aren't taught in America, I mean, Huck is not taught in a lot of, well, Huck is not taught in several states in America. Wouldn't say a lot. Because of its attitude to race.
Yeah,
and so then you get this argument, which is a completely different argument, which we'll have to have when we read Huck, about the use of the N-word, as whether a book that uses the N-word, I mean, Mice and Men uses it about 10 times. Huck uses it about 10 times every page. But that, of course, is the language that was being spoken at the time. But that, therefore, causes a problem.
Yeah.
I would argue there's absolutely no... Well, I would argue there's no interpretation of the race element of Huck other than Twain is trying to find a way to examine slavery and say that it's morally repugnant. But it's not surprising that in doing so, he uses the language that was prevalent at the time that he was writing. And you could also argue that if he's using the N-word, and it's upsetting to his readers at the time, which I don't know if it was, but let's assume it might be, that further reinforces how wrong the slavery was. Because the word is being used. But the word was being used at the time. The word was being used by everybody, including slaves. The word, as used in Huck, probably 70% of its time is just, well, I say just, but it's a synonym for slave. It is just a word that means slave. it's not being used. It's like everything we've talked about, weaponized language in Jerusalem. A lot of the usage of that word in Huck is non-weaponized. So it grates, it offends, it's difficult, but it's not being used as a weaponized word. Every now and then, of course, it is, and that's what we have to notice. It's like Troy and his foul language. He's the one that weaponizes all that sexual abuse in terms of language, taboo words and so on. And suddenly you realize what that tells us about his character. And I would argue exactly the same happens with Huck. I think it's a very important book to read myself. Go on.
But in terms of like how Gatsby wasn't really read by the society at the time, the fact that it's still like kind of sensitive to some areas of the world more than others, that's what I meant to say by American schools and
I see what you mean. I know what you mean. I think Gatsby is read everywhere, but I don't think Gatsby is read in any way as a wasn't life great novel. Having said that, I can remember reading Gatsby in the 1970s when I was at school, and I don't remember anybody telling me that it was a critique, because that was actually the explosion of its popularity, and there was a wonderful film version of it made in the 70s with Robert Redford that was even more soft focus than the Leonardo DiCaprio one. I mean, the whole thing is just soft focus. But I think there is an acceptance, and there is an increasing acceptance, you know, as we get away from someone like Fitzgerald, that you have to look very carefully at him as a writer. Undoubtedly, he has a very complex personal life, which undoubtedly comes out in his writings, but also he undoubtedly had some fairly repugnant views on race and things, which again comes out really quite strongly in his writing. In this book, of course, it doesn't, because he just leaves it out. Other than, and this is the thing about, so talk about the difference between race and immigration, I know it's the same thing, but if you think how white this book is, but then you also think, like we started to talk about with Wolf Scheme and other things, how keen he is to show the othering of the races who aren't good, upstanding white Americans. And how all the time there is this, even for totally inoffensive characters, like his servant, you know, his Nix Finn, who only gets about four mentions in the text, but every time she's mentioned, my Finnish woman, her Finnish ways, muttering in her Finnish way, whatever it might be. You know, he wants to absolutely make it clear that she's foreign. Just as he does with Michaelis, the cafe owner, just as he does with the Italian boys setting bangers on the railway line. Those boys don't have to be Italian at all. But he wants us to know that they are. Because they're others. And I think that's really, really strong. And I think, I suspect that that attitude, and the Nordism attitude, this idea of Nordic purity, was a real thing in the 20s. And I'm sure that comes about in part because of the explosion of migration in the 1900s. That then you've got a generation responding to it, saying, look what's happened to our country. Look what's happened to our city. It's become, you know, Naples, or whatever it might be, and all the problems that incurs. I'll stop recording that.